Side 6. When the Count and Countess had departed, Poirot looked across at the other two.
"You see," he said, "we make progress."
"Excellent work," said Monsieur Bouc cordially. "For my part, I should never have dreamed of suspecting Count and Countess and Rani. I will admit I thought them quite hors de combat. I suppose there is no doubt that she committed the crime. It is rather sad. Still, they will not guillotine her. There are extenuating circumstances. A few years' imprisonment, that will be all."
"In fact, you are quite certain of her guilt."
"Oh, my dear friend, surely there is no doubt of it. I thought your reassuring manner was only to smooth things over till we are dug out of the snow and the police take charge."
"And you do not believe the Count's positive assertion on his word of honour that his wife is innocent?"
"Mon cher, naturally, what else could he say? He adores his wife, he wants to save her, he tells his lie very well, quite in the grand seigneur manner. But what else than a lie could it be?"
"Well, you know, I had the preposterous idea that it might be the truth."
"No, no, no. The handkerchief, remember, the handkerchief clinches the matter."
"Oh, I'm not so sure about the handkerchief. You remember, I always told you that there were two possibilities as to the ownership of the handkerchief."
"But all the same..."
Monsieur Bouc broke off. The door at the end had opened, and Princess Dragomirov entered the dining car. She came straight to them, and all three men rose to their feet. She spoke to Poirot, ignoring the others.
"I believe, monsieur," she said, "that you have a handkerchief of mine."
Poirot shot a glance of triumph at the other two.
"Is this it, madame?"
He produced a little square of fine cambric.
"That is it. It has my initial in the corner."
"Oh, but Madame la Princesse, that is a letter H," said Monsieur Bouc. "Your Christian name, pardon me, is Natalia."
She gave him a cold stare.
"That is correct, monsieur. My handkerchiefs are always initialed in the Russian characters. H is N in Russian."
Monsieur Bouc was somewhat taken aback. There was something about this indomitable old lady which made him feel flustered and uncomfortable.
"You did not tell us that this handkerchief was yours at the inquiry this morning?"
"You did not ask me,"
said the princess dryly.
"Pray be seated, madame," said Poirot.
She sighed.
"I may as well, I suppose."
She sat down.
"You need not make a long business of this, monsieur. Your next question will be, how did my handkerchief come to be lying by a murdered man's body? My reply to that is that I have no idea."
"You have really no idea?"
"None whatever."
"You will excuse me, madame, but how much can we rely upon the truthfulness of your replies?"
Poirot said the words very softly, and Princess Dragomirov answered contemptuously.
"I suppose you mean because I did not tell you that Helena Andrenier was Mrs. Armstrong's sister?"
"In fact, you deliberately lied to us in the matter."
"Certainly. I would do the same again. Her mother was my friend. I believe, monsieur, in loyalty to one's friends and one's family and one's caste."
"You do not believe in doing your utmost to further the ends of justice?"
"In this case, I consider that justice, strict justice, has been done."
Poirot leaned forward.
"But you see my difficulty, madame. In this matter of the handkerchief, even, am I to believe you? Or are you shielding your friend's daughter?"
"Oh, I see what you mean."
Her face broke into a grim smile.
"Well, monsieur, this statement of mine can be easily proved. I will give you the address of the people in Paris who make my handkerchiefs. You have only to show them the one in question, and they will inform you that it was made to my order over a year ago. The handkerchief is mine, monsieur."
She rose.
Have you anything further you wish to ask me?
Your maid, madame, did she recognize this handkerchief when we showed it to her this morning?
Oh, she must have done so. She saw it and said nothing. Ah, well, that shows that she, too, can be loyal.
With a slight inclination of her head, she passed out of the dining car.
So that was it, murmured Poirot softly. I noticed just a trifling hesitation when I asked the maid if she knew to whom the handkerchief belonged. Oh, she was uncertain whether or not to admit that it was her mistress's, but how does that fit in with that strange central idea of mine? Yes, it might well be.
Ah, said Monsieur Bouc with a characteristic gesture. She is a terrible old lady, that.
Could she have murdered Ratchet?
Asked Poirot of the doctor. He shook his head.
No, those blows, the ones delivered with great force, penetrating the muscle, never, never, never could anyone with so frail a physique inflict them.
But the feebler ones?
Well, the feebler ones, yes.
I am thinking, said Poirot, of the incident this morning when I said to her that the strength was in her will rather than in her arm. It was in the nature of a trap, that remark. I wanted to see if she would look down at her right or her left arm. She did neither. She looked at them both. But she made a strange reply. She said, No, I have no strength in these. I do not know whether to be sorry or glad. A curious remark, that. It confirms me in my belief about the crime.
But it did not settle the point about the left-handedness.
No. Oh, by the way, did you notice that Count Andragny keeps his handkerchief in his right-hand breast pocket?
Monsieur Bouc shook his head. His mind reverted to the astonishing revelations of the last half-hour. He murmured,
Lies, and again lies. It amazes me the amount of lies we had told to us this morning.
There are more still to discover, said Poirot cheerfully.
You think so?
Well, I should be very disappointed if it is not so.
But such duplicity is terrible, said Monsieur Bouc. But it seems to please you, he added reproachfully.
Why, it has this advantage, said Poirot. If you confront anyone who has lied with the truth, they usually admit it, often out of sheer surprise. It is only necessary to guess right to produce your effect. Now that is the only way to conduct this case. I select each passenger in turn, consider their evidence, and say to myself, if so-and-so is lying, on what point are they lying, and what is the reason for the lie? And I answer, if they are lying, if you mark, it could only be for such a reason and on such a point. We have done that once very successfully with Countess Andragny. We shall now proceed to try the same method on several other passengers.
And supposing, my friend, that your guess happens to be wrong?
Well, then one person at any rate will be completely freed from suspicion.
Ah, a process of elimination, huh?
Exactly.
And who do we tackle next?
We are going to tackle that Paca Sahib, Colonel Arbuthnot.
Chapter 6. A Second Interview with Colonel Arbuthnot. Colonel Arbuthnot was clearly annoyed at being summoned to the dining car for a second interview. His face wore a most forbidding expression as he sat down and said, Well?
All my apologies for troubling you a second time, said Poirot, but there is still some information that I think you might be able to give us.
Indeed, I hardly think so.
To begin with, you see this pipe cleaner?
Yes.
Is it one of yours?
Don't know. I don't put a private mark on them, you know.
Are you aware, Colonel Arbuthnot, that you are the only man amongst the passengers in the Stamboukale carriage who smokes a pipe?
In that case, it probably is one of mine.
Do you know where it was found?
Not in the least idea.
It was found by the body of the murdered man.
Colonel Arbuthnot raised his eyebrows.
Can you tell us, Colonel Arbuthnot, how it is likely to have got there?
If you mean, did I drop it there myself?
No, I didn't. Did you go into Monsieur Ratchet's compartment at any time?
I never even spoke to the man.
You never spoke to him, and you did not murder him?
The Colonel's eyebrows went up again sardonically.
If I had,
I should hardly be likely to acquaint you with the fact. As a matter of fact, I didn't murder the fellow.
Ah, well, murmured Poirot, it is of no consequence.
I beg your pardon.
I said that it was of no consequence.
Oh. Arbuthnot looked taken aback. He eyed Poirot uneasily.
Because, you see, continued the little man, the pipe cleaner, it is of no importance. I can myself think of 11 other excellent explanations of its presence.
Arbuthnot stared at him.
What I really wish to see you about was quite another matter, went on Poirot. Miss Debenham may have told you, perhaps, that I overheard some words spoken to you at the station of Cognac.
Arbuthnot did not reply.
She said, not now, when it's all over, when it's behind us. Do you know to what those words referred?
I'm sorry, Monsieur Poirot, but I must refuse to answer that question.
Pourquoi?
The Colonel said stiffly.
I suggest that you should ask Miss Debenham herself for the meaning of those words.
I have done so.
And she refused to tell you?
Yes.
Then I should think it would have been perfectly plain, even to you, that my lips are sealed.
You will not give away a lady's secret, huh?
You can put it that way, if you like.
Miss Debenham told me that they referred to a private matter of her own.
Well, then why not accept her word for it?
Because, Colonel Arbuthnot, Miss Debenham is what one might call a highly suspicious character.
Nonsense, said the Colonel with warmth.
It is not nonsense. You have nothing whatever against her.
Well, not the fact that Miss Debenham was companion governess in the Armstrong household at the time of the kidnapping of little Daisy Armstrong?
There was a minute's dead silence. Poirot nodded his head gently.
You see, he said, we know more than you think. If Miss Debenham is innocent, why did she conceal that fact? Why did she tell me that she had never been in America?
The Colonel cleared his throat.
Look, aren't you possibly making a mistake?
I am making no mistake. Why did Miss Debenham lie to me?
Colonel Arbuthnot shrugged his shoulders.
Well, you'd better ask her.
I still think that you're wrong. Poirot raised his voice and called. One of the restaurant attendants came from the far end of the car.
Go and ask the English lady in number 11 if she will be good enough to come here.
Bien, monsieur.
The man departed. The four men sat in silence. Colonel Arbuthnot's face looked as though it were carved out of wood. It was rigid and impassive. The man returned.
The lady is just coming, monsieur.
Thank you.
A minute or two later, Mary Debenham entered the dining car. Chapter 7. The Identity of Mary Debenham. She wore no hat. Her head was thrown back as though in defiance. The sweep of her hair back from her face, the curve of her nostrils suggested the figurehead of a ship plunging gallantly into a rough sea. In that moment, she was beautiful. Her eyes went to Arbuthnot for a minute, just a minute. She said to Poirot, "You wish to see me?"
"Yeah, I wish to ask you, mademoiselle, why you lied to us this morning."
"Lied to you? I don't know what you mean."
"You concealed the fact that at the time of the Armstrong tragedy you were actually living in the house. You told me that you had never been in America?"
He saw her flinch for a moment and then recover herself.
"Yes,"
she said, "that is true."
"No, mademoiselle, it was false."
"Well, you misunderstood me. I mean that it is true that I lied to you."
"Ah, you admit it?"
Her lips curved into a smile. "Well, certainly, since you found me out."
"You are at least frank, mademoiselle."
"There doesn't seem anything else for me to be."
"Well, of course, that is true. And now, mademoiselle, may I ask you the reason for these evasions?"
"Well, I should have thought the reason leapt to the eye, Monsieur Poirot."
"Ah, but it does not leap to mine, mademoiselle."
She said in a quiet, even voice, with a trace of hardness in it, "I have my living to get."
"You mean?"
She raised her eyes and looked him full in the face. "How much do you know, Monsieur Poirot, of the fight to get and keep decent employment? Do you think that a girl who had been detained in connection with a murder case, whose name and perhaps photographs were reproduced in the English papers, do you think that any nice, ordinary, middle-class Englishwoman would want to engage that girl as governess to her daughters?"
Well, I do not see why not, if no blame attached to you.
Oh, blame? It's not the blame. It is publicity. So far, Monsieur Poirot, I have succeeded in life. I have had well-paid, pleasant posts. I was not going to risk the position I had attained when no good end could have been served.
Well, I will venture to suggest, mademoiselle, that I would have been the best judge of that, not you.
She shrugged her shoulders.
For instance, you could have helped me in the matter of identification.
But what do you mean?
Is it possible, mademoiselle, that you did not recognize in the Countess Andragny, Mrs. Armstrong's young sister whom you taught in New York?
Countess Andragny?
No.
She shook her head.
Well, it may seem extraordinary to you, but I did not recognize her. Well, she was not grown up, you see, when I knew her. That was over 3 years ago. But it is true that the Countess reminded me of someone. It puzzled me. But she looked so foreign. I never connected her with a little American schoolgirl. It is true that I only glanced at her casually when coming into the restaurant car. I noticed her clothes more than her face.
She smiled faintly.
Well, women do. And then, well, I had my own preoccupations.
And you will not tell me your secret, mademoiselle?
Poirot's voice was very gentle and persuasive. She said in a low voice,
I can't. I can't.
And suddenly, without warning, she broke down, dropping her face down upon her outstretched arms and crying as though her heart would break. The Colonel sprang up and stood awkwardly beside her.
Well, look here!
He stopped, turning round, scowled fiercely at Poirot.
I'll break every bone in your damn body, you dirty little whippersnapper,
he said.
Monsieur,
protested Monsieur Bouc. Arbuthnot had turned back to the girl.
Mary, look, for God's sake.
She sprang up.
It's nothing. I'm all right. You don't need me any more, do you, Monsieur Poirot? If you do, you must come and find me. Oh, what an idiot. What an idiot I'm making of myself.
She hurried out of the car. Arbuthnot, before following her, turned once more on Poirot.
Miss Debenham's got nothing to do with this business. Nothing, do you hear? And if she's worried and interfered with, you'll have me to deal with.
He strode out.
Oh, I like to see angry Englishmen, said Poirot. They are very amusing. The more emotional they feel, the less command they have of language.
But Monsieur Bouc was not interested in the emotional reactions of Englishmen. He was overcome by admiration of his friend.
Oh, mon cher, vous êtes épatant,
he cried.
Another miraculous guest, c'est formidable.
It is incredible how you think of these things,
said Dr. Constantine admiringly.
Oh, no, I claim no credit this time. It was not a guess. Countess Andragny practically told me.
Comment? Surely not.
You remember I asked her about her governess or companion? I had already decided in my mind that if Mary Debenham were mixed up in the matter, she must have figured in the household in some such capacity.
Yes, but the Countess Andragny described a totally different person.
Exactly. A tall, middle-aged woman with red hair. In fact, the exact opposite in every respect of Miss Debenham. So much so as to be quite remarkable. But then she had to invent a name quickly. And there it was that the unconscious association of ideas gave her away. She said, Miss Freebody, you remember?
Yes.
Eh bien, you may not know it, but there is a shop in London that was called, until recently, Debenham and Freebody.
With the name Debenham running in her head, the Countess clutches at another name quickly. And the first name that comes is Freebody.
Naturally, I understood. Immediately. So that is yet another lie. Why did she do it?
Oh, possibly more loyalty. It makes things a little difficult, huh?
Ma foi,
said Monsieur Bouc with violence.
But does everybody on this train tell lies?
That, said Poirot, is what we are about to find out.
Chapter 8. Further Surprising Revelations.
Oh, nothing would surprise me now,
said Monsieur Bouc.
Nothing. Even if everybody in the train proved to have been in the Armstrong household, I should not express surprise.
That is a very profound remark, said Poirot. Would you like to see what your favorite suspect, the Italian, has to say for himself?
Oh, you are going to make another of these famous guesses of yours?
Precisely.
It is really a most extraordinary case, said Constantine.
No, it is most natural.
Monsieur Bouc flung up his arms in comic despair.
If this is what you call natural, mon ami.
Words failed him. Poirot had, by this time, requested the dining car attendant to fetch Antonio Foscarelli. The big Italian had a wary look in his eye as he came in. He shot nervous glances from side to side like a trapped animal.
What do you want? He said. I have nothing to tell you, nothing do you hear. Per Dio, eh?
He struck his hand on the table.
Oh, yes, you have something more to tell us, said Poirot firmly.
The truth. The truth?
He shot an uneasy glance at Poirot. All the assurance and geniality had gone out of his manner.
Mais oui. It may be that I know it already, but it will be a point in your favor if it comes from you spontaneously.
You talk like the American police. Come clean. That is what they say. Come clean.
Ah, so you have had experience with the New York police?
No, no, never. They could not prove a thing against me, but it was not for want of trying.
Poirot said quietly,
and that was in the Armstrong case, was it not? You were the chauffeur?
His eyes met those of the Italian. The bluster went out of the big man. He was like a pricked balloon.
Since you know, why ask me?
Why did you lie this morning?
Business reasons. Besides, I do not trust the Yugoslav police. They hate Italians. They would not have given me justice.
Ah, perhaps it is exactly justice that they would have given you.
No, 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 I had nothing to do with this business last night. I never left my carriage. The long-faced Englishman, he can tell you so. It was not I who killed this pig, this ratchet. You cannot prove anything against me.
Poirot was writing something on a piece of paper. He looked up and said quietly,
"Very good. You can go."
Foscarelli lingered uneasily.
You realize that it was not I? That I could have had nothing to do with it?
I said that you could go.
But it is a conspiracy, huh? You are going to frame me? All for a pig of a man who should have gone to the chair? It was an infamy that he did not. If it had been me, if I had been arrested...
But it was not you. You had nothing to do with the kidnapping of the child.
What is it that you are saying? Why, that little one. She was the delight of the house. Tonio, she called me. And she would sit in the car and pretend to hold the wheel. All the household worshipped her. Even the police came to understand that. Oh, the beautiful little one.
His voice had softened. The tears came into his eyes. Then he wheeled round abruptly on his heel and strode out of the dining car.
Pietro,
called Poirot. The dining car attendant came at a run.
The number 10, the Swedish lady?
Bien, monsieur.
Another? Cried Monsieur Bouc. Ah, no, it is not possible. I tell you, it is not possible.
Mon cher, we have to know. Even if in the end everybody on the train proves to have a motive for killing Ratchet, we have to know. Now, once we know, we can settle once for all where the guilt lies.
But my head is spinning,
groaned Monsieur Bouc. Greta Olsen was ushered in sympathetically by the attendant. She was weeping bitterly. She collapsed on the seat facing Poirot and wept steadily into a large handkerchief.
Oh, now do not distress yourself, mademoiselle. Do not distress yourself.
Poirot patted her on the shoulder.
Just a few little words of truth, that is all. You were the nurse who was in charge of little Daisy Armstrong.
It is true. It is true,
wept the wretched woman.
She was an angel. a little sweet, trusting angel. She knew nothing but kindness and love. And she was taken away by that wicked man, cruelly treated. And her poor mother, and the other little one who never lived at all. You cannot understand. You cannot know. If you had been there as I was, if you had seen the whole terrible tragedy. I ought to have told you the truth about myself this morning, but I was afraid. I did so rejoice that that evil man was dead, and that he could not any more kill or torture little children. I cannot speak. I have no words.
She wept with more vehemence than ever. Poirot continued to pat her gently on the shoulder.
There, there, I comprehend. I comprehend everything, everything I tell you. I will ask you no more questions. It is enough that you have admitted what I know to be the truth. I understand, I tell you.
By now, inarticulate with sobs, Greta Olsen rose and groped her way blindly towards the door. As she reached it, she collided with a man coming in. It was the valet, Masterman. He came straight up to Poirot and spoke in his usual, quiet, unemotional voice. "I hope I'm not intruding, sir. I thought it best to come along at once, sir, and tell you the truth. I was Colonel Armstrong's batman in the war, sir, and afterwards I was his valet in New York. I'm afraid I concealed that fact this morning. It was very wrong of me, sir, and I thought I'd better come and make a clean breast of it. But I hope, sir, that you're not suspecting Tonio in any way. Old Tonio, sir, no, he wouldn't hurt a fly. And I can swear positively that he never left the carriage all last night. So you see, sir, he couldn't have done it. Tonio may be a foreigner, sir, but he's a very gentle creature, not like those nasty, murdering Italians one reads about. He stopped. Poirot looked steadily at him.
Is that all you have to say? That is all, sir.
He paused. Then, as Poirot did not speak, he made an apologetic little bow, and after a momentary hesitation left the dining car in the same quiet, unobtrusive fashion as he had come.
This, said Dr. Constantine, is more wildly improbable than any Roman policier I have ever read. I agree, said Monsieur Bouc. Of the 12 passengers in that coach, 9 have been proved to have had connection with the Armstrong case. What next, I ask you? Or should I say, who next?
I can almost give you the answer to your question, said Poirot. Here comes our American sleuth, Monsieur Hartmann.
Is he too coming to confess?
Before Poirot could reply, the American had reached their table. He cocked an alert eye at them, and, sitting down, he drawled out,
"Just exactly what's up on this train. It seems bughouse to me."
Poirot twinkled at him.
"Are you quite sure, Monsieur Hartmann, that you yourself were not the gardener at the Armstrong home?" "They didn't have a garden," replied Mr. Hartmann, literally. "Or the butler?" "Well, I haven't got the fancy manner for a place like that. No, I never had any connection with the Armstrong house, but I'm beginning to believe I'm about the only one on this train who hadn't. Can you beat it? That's what I say. Can you beat it? Huh?"
"It is certainly a little surprising," said Poirot mildly.
"C'est rigolo," burst from Monsieur Bouc.
"Have you any ideas of your own about the crime, Monsieur Hartmann?" inquired Poirot.
"Well, no, sir. It's got me beat. I don't know how to figure it out. They can't all be in it. But which one is the guilty party is beyond me. How did you get wise to all this? That's what I want to know."
"Well, I just guessed."
"Then believe me, you're a pretty slick guesser. Yeah, I'll tell the world you're a slick guesser."
Mr. Hartmann leaned back and looked to Poirot admiringly.
"You'll excuse me," he said, "but no one would believe it to look at you. I take off my hat to you, I do indeed."
"You are too kind, Monsieur Hartmann."
"Not at all. I've got to hand it to you."
"All the same,"
said Poirot. The problem is not yet quite solved. Can we say with authority that we know who killed Monsieur Ratchet?
Ah, count me out, said Mr. Hardman. I'm not saying anything at all. I'm just full of natural admiration. What about the other two you've not had a guess at yet? The old American dame and the lady's maid. I suppose we can take it that they're the only innocent parties on the train?
Unless, said Poirot, smiling, we can fit them into our little collection as, shall we say, housekeeper and cook in the Armstrong household?
Well, nothing in the world would surprise me now, said Mr. Hardman with quiet resignation. Bug house. That's what this business is. Bug house.
Ah, mon cher, that would be indeed stretching coincidence a little too far, said Monsieur Bouc. They cannot all be in it.
Poirot looked at him. You do not understand, he said. You do not understand at all. Tell me, he said, do you know who killed Ratchet?
Do you? Countered Monsieur Bouc.
Poirot nodded.
Oh, yes, he said. I have known for some time.
It is so clear that I wonder you have not seen it also. He looked at Hardman and asked, and you? The detective shook his head. He stared at Poirot curiously.
I don't know, he said. I don't know at all.
Which of them was it? Poirot was silent a minute, and then he said, if you will be so good, Monsieur Hardman, assemble everyone here. There are two possible solutions of this case. I want to lay them both before you all.
Chapter 9. Poirot propounds two solutions. The passengers came crowding into the restaurant car and took their seats round the tables. They all bore more or less the same expression, one of expectancy mingled with apprehension. The Swedish lady was still weeping, and Mrs. Hubbard was comforting her.
Now, you must just take a hold on yourself, my dear. Everything's going to be perfectly all right. You mustn't lose your grip on yourself. If one of us is a nasty murderer, we know quite well it isn't you. Why, anyone would be crazy even to think of such a thing. You sit here, and I'll stay right by you. And don't you worry...
Her voice died away as Poirot stood up. The wagonly conductor was hovering in the doorway.
You permit that I stay, monsieur?
Oh, certainly, Michel.
Poirot cleared his throat.
Monsieur et madame, I will speak in English, since I think all of you know a little of that language. We are here to investigate the death of Samuel Edward Ratchet, alias Cassidy. There are two possible solutions of the crime. I shall put them both before you, and I shall ask Monsieur Bouc and Dr. Constantine here to judge which solution is the right one. Now, you all know the facts of the case. Mr. Ratchet was found stabbed this morning. He was last known to be alive at 12:37 last night, when he spoke to the wagon-lee conductor through the door. A watch in his pajama pocket was found to be badly dented, and it had stopped at 1:15. Dr. Constantine, who examined the body when found, puts the time of death as having occurred between midnight and 2 in the morning. At half an hour after midnight, as you all know, the train ran into a snowdrift, and after that time, it was impossible for anyone to leave the train. The evidence of Monsieur Hardman, who is a member of a New York detective agency, several heads turned to look at Mr. Hardman, shows that no one could have passed his compartment, number 16 at the extreme end, without being seen by him. Now, we are therefore forced to the conclusion that the murderer is to be found among the occupants of one particular coach, the Stamboul-Calais coach. That, I will say, was our theory.
Comment?
Ejaculated Monsieur Bouc, startled.
But I will put before you an alternative theory. It is very simple.
Mr. Ratchett had a certain enemy whom he feared. He gave Mr. Hardman a description of this enemy and told him that the attempt, if made at all, would most probably be made on the second night out from Stamboul. Now, I put it to you, ladies and gentlemen, that Mr. Ratchett knew a good deal more than he told. The enemy, as Mr. Ratchett expected, joined the train at Belgrade or possibly at Vinkovki by the door left open by Colonel Arbuthnot and Mr. McQueen, who had just descended to the platform. He was provided with a suit of wagonly uniform, which he wore over his ordinary clothes, and a passkey which enabled him to gain access to Mr. Ratchett's compartment in spite of the door being locked. Mr. Ratchett was under the influence of a sleeping draught. This man stabbed him with great ferocity and left the compartment through the communicating door, leading to Mrs. Hubbard's compartment. "Yet that's so," said Mrs. Hubbard, nodding her head. He thrust the dagger he had used into Mrs. Hubbard's sponge bag in passing. Without knowing it, he lost the button of his uniform. Then he slipped out of the compartment and along the corridor. He hastily thrust the uniform into a suitcase in an empty compartment, and a few minutes later, dressed in ordinary clothes, he left the train just before it started off. Again, using the same means of egress, the door near the dining car. Everybody gasped.
"Well, what about that watch?" demanded Mr. Hartman.
"There you have the explanation of the whole thing. Mr. Ratchett had omitted to put his watch back an hour, as he should have done, at Zarebrod. His watch still registered Eastern European time, which is 1 hour ahead of Central European time. It was 12:15 when Mr. Ratchett was stabbed, not 1:15.
"Oh, but it is absurd, that explanation," cried Monsieur Bouc. "What if the voices spoke from the compartment at 1:23? It was either the voice of Ratchett or else of his murderer."
"Not necessarily. It might have been, well, a third person. One who had gone in to speak to Ratchett and found him dead. He rang the bell to summon the conductor. Then, as you express it, the wind rose in him. He was afraid of being accused of the crime, and he spoke pretending to be Ratchett."
"C'est possible," admitted Monsieur Bouc grudgingly.
Poirot stared at Mrs. Hubbard.
"Yes, madame? You were going to say?"
"Well, I don't quite know what I was going to say. Do you think I forgot to put my watch back, too?"
"No, madame. I think you heard the man pass through, but unconsciously. Later, you had a nightmare of a man being in your compartment and woke up with a start and rang for the conductor."
"Well, I suppose that's possible," admitted Mrs. Hubbard.
Princess Dragomiroff was looking at Poirot with a very direct glance.
"How do you explain the evidence of my maid, monsieur?"
"Oh, very simply, madame. Your maid recognized the handkerchief I showed her as yours. She somewhat clumsily tried to shield you. But she did encounter the man, but earlier, while the train was at Vinkovki station. She pretended to have seen him at a later hour with a confused idea of giving you a watertight alibi."
The princess bowed her head.
"You have thought of everything, monsieur. I admire you."
There was silence. Then everyone jumped as Dr. Constantine suddenly hit the table a blow with his fist.
"But no," he said. "No, no, and again, no. That is an explanation that will not hold water. It is deficient in 12 minor points. The crime was not committed so. And Monsieur Poirot must know that perfectly well."
Poirot turned a curious glance on him.
"I see," he said, "that I shall have to give you my second solution. But do not abandon this one too abruptly, eh? You may agree with it later."
He turned back again to face the others.
"There is another possible solution of the crime. This is how I arrived at it. When I had heard all the evidence, I leaned back and shut my eyes and began to think. And certain points presented themselves to me as worthy of attention. I enumerated these points to my two colleagues. Some I had already elucidated, such as a grease spot on a passport, etc. I will run over the points now that remain. The first and most important is a remark made to me by Monsieur Bouc in the restaurant car at lunch on the first day after leaving Istanbul, to the effect that the company assembled was interesting because it was so varied, representing as it did all classes and nationalities. I agreed with him, but when this particular point came into my mind, I tried to imagine whether such an assembly were ever likely to be collected under any other conditions. And the answer I made to myself was, only in America. In America, there might be a household composed of just such varied nationalities, eh? An Italian chauffeur, an English governess, a Swedish nurse, a French lady's maid, and so on. That led me to my scheme of guessing. That is, casting each person for a certain part in the Armstrong drama, much as a producer casts a play. Well, that gave me an extremely interesting and satisfactory result. I had also examined, in my own mind, each separate person's evidence with some curious results. Take first the evidence of Mr. McQueen. Now, my first interview with him was entirely satisfactory, but in my second, he made rather a curious remark. I had described to him the finding of a note mentioning the Armstrong case. He said, but surely, and then paused and went on. I mean, that was rather careless of the old man. Now, I could feel that that was not what he had started out to say. Supposing what he had meant to say was, but surely that was burned. In which case, McQueen knew of the note and of its destruction. In other words, he was either the murderer or an accomplice of the murderer. Very good. Then the valet. He said his master was in the habit of taking a sleeping draught when travelling by train. That might be true. But would Ratchet have taken one last night? The automatic under his pillow gives a lie to that statement. Ratchet intended to be on the alert last night. Whatever narcotic was administered to him must have been done so without his knowledge. By whom? Obviously, by McQueen or the valet. Now we come to the evidence of Monsieur Hardman. I believed all that he told me about his own identity. But when it came to the actual methods he had employed to guard Mr. Ratchet, his story was neither more or less than absurd. The only way effectively to have protected Ratchet was to have passed the night actually in his compartment or in some spot where he could watch the door. Now, the only thing that his evidence did show, plainly, was that no one in any other part of the train could possibly have murdered Ratchet. It drew a clear circle round the Istanbul-Calais carriage. That seemed to me a rather curious and inexplicable fact. And I put it aside to think it over. You probably have all heard by now of the few words I overheard between Miss Debenham and Colonel Arbuthnot. Now, the interesting thing to my mind was the fact that Colonel Arbuthnot called her Mary, and was clearly on terms of intimacy with her. But the Colonel was only supposed to have met her a few days previously. And I know Englishmen of the Colonel's type. Even if he had fallen in love with the young lady at first sight, he would have advanced slowly and with decorum, not rushing things. Therefore, I concluded that Colonel Arbuthnot and Miss Debenham were in reality well acquainted, and were, for some reason, pretending to be strangers. Another small point was Miss Debenham's easy familiarity with the term long distance for a telephone call. Yet Miss Debenham had told me that she had never been in the States. Now, to pass
to another witness. Mrs. Hubbard had told us that lying in bed, she was unable to see whether the communicating door was bolted or not, and so asked Miss Olson to see for her now. Though her statement would have been perfectly true if she had been occupying compartments numbers 2, 4, or 12, or any even number, where the bolt is directly under the handle of the door, in the uneven numbers, such as compartment number 3, the bolt is well above the handle, and could not therefore be masked by the sponge bag in the least. I was forced to the conclusion that Mrs. Hubbard was inventing an incident that had never occurred. And here, let me say just a word or two about times. To my mind, the really interesting point about the dented watch was the place where it was found. In Ratchet's pajama pocket? A singularly uncomfortable and unlikely place to keep one's watch. Especially as there is a watch hook provided just by the head of the bed. I felt sure, therefore, that the watch had been deliberately placed in the pocket and faked. The crime, then, was not committed at 1:15. Was it then committed earlier? To be exact, at 1:23. Now, my friend Monsieur Bouc advanced as an argument in favor of it a loud cry which awoke me from my sleep. Now, that if Ratchet were heavily drugged, he could not have cried out. If he had been capable of crying out, he would have been capable of making some kind of a struggle to defend himself, and there were no signs of any such struggle. I remembered that McQueen had called attention, not once, but twice, and the second time in a very blatant manner, to the fact that Ratchet could speak no French. I came to the conclusion that the old business at 1:23 was a comedy played for my benefit. Anyone might see through the watch business. It is a common enough device in detective stories. They assumed that I should see through it, and that, pluming myself on my own cleverness, I would go on to assume that since Ratchet spoke no French, the voice I heard at 1:23 could not be his, and that Ratchet must already be dead. But I am convinced that at 1:23, Ratchet was lying in his drugged sleep. But the device had succeeded. I have opened my door and looked out. I have actually heard the French phrase used. If I am so unbelievably dense as not to realize the significance of that phrase, it must be brought to my attention. If necessary, McQueen can come right out in the open. He can say, "Excuse me, Monsieur Poirot, that can't have been Mr. Ratchet speaking. He can't speak French." Now, when was the real time of the crime? And who killed him? In my opinion, and this is only an opinion, Ratchet was killed at some time very close upon 2:00, the latest hour the doctor gives us as possible. As to who killed him? He paused, looking at his audience. He couldn't complain of any lack of attention. Every eye was fixed upon him. In the stillness you could have heard a pin drop. He went on slowly. I was particularly struck by the extraordinary difficulty of proving a case against any one person on the train, and on the rather curious coincidence that in each case the testimony giving an alibi came from what I might describe as an unlikely person. Thus, Mr. McQueen and Colonel Arbuthnot provided alibis for each other, two persons between whom it seemed most unlikely there should be any prior acquaintanceship. The same thing happened with the English valet and the Italian, with the Swedish lady and the English girl. I said to myself, this is extraordinary. They cannot all be in it. And then, monsieur, I saw light.
They were all in it. For so many people connected with the Armstrong case to be travelling by the same train by a coincidence was not only unlikely, it was impossible. It must be not chance, but design. I remembered a remark of Colonel Arbuthnot's about trial by jury. A jury is composed of 12 people, huh? There were 12 passengers. Ratchet was stabbed 12 times. And the thing that had worried me all along, huh? The extraordinary crowd travelling in the Stambukale coach at a slack time of year was explained. Ratchet had escaped justice in America. There was no question as to his guilt. I visualized a self-appointed jury of 12 people who condemned him to death and were forced by the exigencies of the case to be their own executioners. And immediately on that assumption, the whole case fell into a beautiful, shining order. I saw it as a perfect mosaic. Each person playing his or her allotted part. It was so arranged that if suspicion should fall on any one person, the evidence of one or more of the others would clear the accused person and confuse the issue. Hartman's evidence was necessary in case some outsider should be suspected of the crime and be unable to prove an alibi. The passengers in the Stamboul carriage were in no danger. Huh? Every minute detail of their evidence was worked out beforehand. The whole thing was a cleverly planned jigsaw puzzle, so arranged that every fresh piece of knowledge that came to light made the solution of the whole more difficult. Huh? As my friend Monsieur Bouc remarked, the case seemed fantastically impossible. Huh? And that was exactly the impression intended to be conveyed. Did the solution explain everything? Oh, yes, it did. The nature of the wounds, each inflicted by a different person. The artificial threatening letters, artificial since they were unreal, written only to be produced as evidence. Oh, doubtless there were real letters warning Ratchet of his fate, which McQueen destroyed, substituting for them these others. Then Hartman's story of being called in by Ratchet? A lie, of course, from beginning to end. The description of the mythical small dark man with a womanish voice, a convenient description since it had the merit of not incriminating any of the actual wagon-lee conductors and would apply equally well to a man or a woman. Now, the idea of stabbing is at first sight a curious one, but on reflection nothing would fit the circumstances so well. A dagger was a weapon that could be used by everyone, strong or weak, and it made no noise. I fancy, though I may be wrong, that each person in turn entered Ratchet's darkened compartment through that of Mrs. Hubbard and struck. They themselves would never know which blow actually killed him. The final letter which Ratchet had probably found on his pillow was carefully burnt. With no clue pointing to the Armstrong case, there would be absolutely no reason for suspecting any of the passengers on the train. It would be put down as an outside job, huh? And a small dark man with a womanish voice yet would actually have been seen by one or more passengers leaving the train at Broad. I do not know exactly what happened when the conspirators discovered that that part of their plan was impossible owing to the accident to the train. But there was, I imagine, a hasty consultation, and then they decided to go through with it. It was true that now one and all of the passengers were bound to come under suspicion. But that possibility had already been foreseen and provided for. No, the only additional thing to be done was to confuse the issue even further. Two so-called clues were dropped in the dead man's compartment. One incriminating Colonel Arbuthnot, who had the strongest alibi and whose connection with the Armstrong family was probably the hardest to prove. And the second clue, the handkerchief, incriminating Princess Dragomirov, who, by virtue of her social position, her particularly frail physique, and the alibi given her by her maid and the conductor, was practically in an unassailable position. Further, to confuse the issue, a red herring was drawn across the trail. The mythical woman in the red kimono. Again, I am to bear witness to this woman's existence. There is a heavy bang at my door. I get up and look out. I see the scarlet kimono disappearing in the distance. A judicious selection of people, the conductor, Miss Debenham and McQueen, will also have seen her. It was, I think, someone with a sense of humor who thoughtfully placed the scarlet kimono on the top of my suitcase whilst I was interviewing people in the dining car. Where the garment came from in the first place, I do not know. I suspect it is the property of Countess Andragny, since her luggage contained only a chiffon negligee so elaborate as to be more a tea gown than a dressing gown. When McQueen first learned that the letter which had been so carefully burnt had in part escaped destruction, and that the word Armstrong was exactly the word remaining, he must at once have communicated his news to the others. It was at this minute that the position of Countess Andragny became acute, and her husband immediately took steps to alter the passport. It was their second piece of bad luck. They one and all agreed to deny utterly any connection with the Armstrong family. They knew I had no immediate means of finding out the truth, and they did not believe that I should go into the matter unless my suspicions were aroused against one particular person. Now, there was one further point to consider. Allowing that my theory of the crime was the correct one, and I believe that it must be the correct one, then obviously the wagon conductor himself must be privy to the plot. But if so, that gave us 13 persons, not 12. Instead of the usual formula of so many people, one is guilty, I was faced with the problem that of 13 persons, one, and one only, was innocent. Which was that person? Huh? I came to a very odd conclusion. I came to the conclusion that the person who had taken no part in the crime was the person who would be considered the most likely to do so. I refer to Countess Andragny. I was impressed by the earnestness of her husband when he swore to me solemnly on his honor that his wife never left her compartment that night. I decided that Count Andragny took, so to speak, his wife's place. If so, then Pierre Michel was definitely one of the 12. But how could one explain his complicity? He was a decent man, who had been many years in the employ of the company, not the kind of man who could be bribed to assist in a crime. Then Pierre Michel must be involved in the Armstrong case. But that seemed very improbable. Then I remembered that the dead nursery maid was French. Supposing that that unfortunate girl had been Pierre Michel's daughter? Now that would explain everything. It would also explain the place chosen for the staging of the crime. Were there any others whose part in the drama was not clear? Colonel Arbuthnot I put down as a friend of the Armstrongs. They had probably been through the war together. The maid, Hildegard Schmidt, I could guess her place in the Armstrong household. I am perhaps over greedy, but I sense a good cook instinctively. I laid a trap for her. She fell into it. I said I knew she was a good cook. She answered, yes, indeed. All my ladies have said so. But if you are employed as a lady's maid, your employers seldom have a chance of learning whether or not you are a good cook. Then there was Hardman. He seemed quite definitely not to belong to the Armstrong household. I could only imagine that he had been in love with the French girl. I spoke to him of the charm of foreign women, and again I obtained the reaction I was looking for. Sudden tears came into his eyes, which he pretended were dazzled by the snow. There remains Mrs. Hubbard. Now, Mrs. Hubbard, let me say, played the most important part in the drama, By occupying the compartment, communicating with that of Ratched, she was more open to suspicion than anyone else. In the nature of things, she could not have an alibi to fall back upon. To play the part, she played the perfectly natural, slightly ridiculous, American fond mother. An artiste was needed. But there was an artiste connected with the Armstrong family. Mrs. Armstrong's mother, Linda Arden, the actress. He stopped. Then, in a soft, rich, dreamy voice, quite unlike the one she had used all the journey, Mrs. Hubbard said, I always fancied myself in comedy parts. She went on still dreamily. That slip about the sponge bag was silly. It shows you should always rehearse properly. We tried it on the way out. I was in an even number compartment then, I suppose. I never thought of the bolts being in different places. She shifted her position a little and looked straight at Poirot. You know all about it, Monsieur Poirot. You're a very wonderful man. But even you can't quite imagine what it was like that awful day in New York. I was just crazy with grief. So were the servants. And Colonel Arbuthnot was there, too. He was John Armstrong's best friend.
Well, he saved my life in the war, said Arbuthnot.
We decided then and there, well, I don't know, perhaps we were mad, I don't know, that the sentence of death that Cassetti had escaped had got to be carried out. There were 12 of us, or rather 11. Suzanne's father was over in France, of course. First we thought we'd draw our lots as to who should do it, but in the end we decided on this way. It was the chauffeur, Antonio, who suggested it. Mary worked out all the details later with Hector McQueen. He'd always adored Sonia, my daughter. And it was he who explained to us exactly how Cassetti's money had managed to get him off. It took a long time to perfect our plan. We had first to track Ratched down. Hardman managed that in the end. And then we had to try to get Masterman and Hector into his employment, or at any rate, one of them. Well, we managed that. Then we had a consultation with Suzanne's father. Colonel Arbuthnot was very keen on having 12 of us. He seemed to think it made it more in order. He didn't like the stabbing idea much, but he agreed that it did solve most of our difficulties. Well, Suzanne's father was willing. Suzanne was his only child. We knew from Hector that Ratched would be coming back from the East sooner or later by the Orient Express. And with Pierre Michel actually working on that train, the chance was too good to be missed. Besides, it would be a good way of not incriminating any outsiders. My daughter's husband had to know, of course, and he insisted on coming on the train with her. Hector wangled it so that Ratched selected the right day for traveling when Michel would be on duty. We meant to engage every carriage in the Stamboul-Calais coach, but unfortunately there was one carriage we couldn't get. It was reserved long beforehand for a director of the company. Mr. Harris, of course, was a myth. But it would have been awkward to have any stranger in Hector's compartment, and then, at the last minute, you came. She stopped. Well, she said, you know everything now. Monsieur Poirot? What are you going to do about it, huh? If it must all come out, can't you lay the blame upon me? And me only? I would have stabbed that man 12 times, willingly. It wasn't only that he was responsible for my daughter's death and her child's, and that of the other child, who might have been alive and happy now. It was more than that. There had been other children before Daisy. There might be others in the future. Society had condemned him. We were only carrying out the sentence.
But it's unnecessary to bring all these others into it. All these good, faithful souls. And poor Michel. And Mary and Colonel Arbuthnot. They love each other.
Her voice was wonderful, echoing through the crowded space. That deep, emotional, heart-stirring voice that had thrilled many a New York audience. Poirot looked at his friend.
Ah, you are director of the company, Monsieur Bouc, he said.
What do you say?
Monsieur Bouc cleared his throat.
In my opinion, Monsieur Poirot, he said, the first theory you put forward
was the correct one. Decidedly so. I suggest that that is a solution we offer to the Yugoslavian police when they arrive. You agree, Doctor?
Certainly I agree, said Dr. Constantine. As regards the medical evidence, I think that I made one or two fantastic suggestions.
Then, said Poirot, having placed my solution before you, I have the honor to retire from the case.
That was Murder on the Orient Express by Agatha Christie, read by David Suchet. We do hope you've enjoyed listening to this Chivers audiobook, and if you'd like to listen to further titles, please contact your local library.